As I was leaving, the people whom I was with were commenting on what wonderful acting they had seen in the movie. And I was sort of privately, mildly outraged to think in terms of the actors when the story itself was so great. What really made it great was Tolstoy's novel, translated perhaps somewhat weakly onto the screen. Well, in the same way, people always look to the instruments, and in looking to what has made Ananda successful, the temptation is to speak of me as the instrument, other people, but me obviously particularly, as the founder. And it doesn't hurt to be reminded that the novelist who wrote the story behind the screenplay is the one who really created the work. In other words, somebody asked me once recently, a reporter asked me, what is the secret of Ananda's success among so many communities that have failed? And my answer was purely and simply, Yogananda. It was his inspiration, his power, his living presence during all these years. Whenever there has been the need for a miracle, there it's been. Whenever there's been the need for guidance, there it's been. Again and again, it's been his power, and even to the extent of many people seeing him or him actually appearing to people and telling them to do things that were needed for Ananda's growth or for the welfare of some particular thing that was being done at that time at or by Ananda. The real power behind anything that I've been able to do, anything that Ananda's been able to do, has really been he. We could say the real power behind him has been God. That would be equally true. But I would like to close this week by offering a tribute, particularly to where that tribute is really due, because of the power of spirituality that he brought to the West, to America, to this whole ideal of cooperative communities. Because of that, I think that this community has succeeded. And I should say much more than I think. In the Catholic Church, they have the tradition of patron saints. Most of these patron saints were sort of nominated to their particular duty long after they died. And it wasn't as if Elmo, who I believe is the patron saint of sailors, had anything to do with deciding that he would be the patron saint of sailors or gave any special blessing to sailors during his lifetime, except that he may have been on a ship once, and that was the best they could come up with when they were looking for a patron saint for sailors. By contrast with that, Yogananda actually, more than just a nominated patron saint, he actually put his blessings into this whole movement. I was there particularly on that occasion when, and we have a photograph of it, where he raised his hands and was chanting Om after saying that he was putting this thought, these vibrations for the success of this movement in the ether. And he said, my words shall not die, is the way he put it. And this power, I believe that if communities, even if they aren't disciples of his, after all, Yogananda called St. Francis his patron saint. That didn't mean Yogananda was a Catholic. So people don't even need to be disciples of this path in order, if they want to start communities, to invoke his blessings and his power. I firmly believe that that has been the secret ingredient in Ananda's success. And so tonight, what I would like to do is begin by simply showing you a few photographs of Yogananda and reading some words about him, a very short slideshow that we showed for the first time during his birthday last January, and people were very moved by it. So perhaps you'll enjoy it. And then I'll just have a few other words to say. Mankind, offspring of God, lives a stranger in this world, though through how many eons of seeking he strives to make matter his home. Into the gray twilight of materialism there shines from time to time a brilliant ray of divine light, penetrating the mist of man's delusions. As the Bhagavad Gita declares, whenever virtue declines and evil is on the rise, I, the Spirit, incarnate myself on earth to restore virtue and to drive out sin. One such divine ray was the great master of yoga, Paramhansa Yogananda.
Yogananda was the author of the spiritual classic Autobiography of a Yogi, one of the best-known spiritual works of this age. He was also the founder of Self-Realization Fellowship, a worldwide organization with its headquarters in Los Angeles, California. Certainly, the impact of somebody that can carry over 30 years after his death, and presumably many, many times those 30 years, indicates a very powerful spirit. What made that spirit powerful was that he was such a clear channel for the divine. A master is not a master in the way that a great artist might be called master, or a great conductor might be called master. The disciples of somebody like Leonardo would call him maestro, and so on. People with egos, functioning with unusual genius, functioning with extraordinary ability to express themselves clearly, extraordinary power and energy. There was none of that in Yogananda's life, nor in the lives of other great masters. They were really only windows through which the divine was pouring its light into this world. You would look into his eyes and you would see that there wasn't a personality there. Because what defines a personality is likes and dislikes. Without any kind of personal reaction, that doesn't mean there isn't reaction, but it's not, I am reacting to you because I like you or I don't like you. It is rather a complete reflection of your own higher self looking back at you, telling you, I'm not really behaving as I should. I remember one time somebody trying to win him with flattery. It was just a trivial little thing, but he saw this disciple and said, how are you? And the disciple said, all right, sir, now, meaning now that I'm seeing you again. Yogananda just looked at him calmly. No judgment, but no acceptance either. Because he was reflecting back to that man a reminder, be sincere. Don't indulge in flattery. That's not friendship. In this way, he would always give back to us our own self. It was not as if he were a separate person from ourself. He was our own higher self. It reminds me of the salutation with which Swami Shivananda, the guru of Chidananda, Satchidananda, etc., with which he would sign his letters. He'd always write, your own self, Swami Shivananda. And this is indeed how these great masters see themselves. When I returned to America from India the first time, I received a telegram from Ananda Moyi Ma inviting me to come to where she was to say goodbye. And I said to her, wouldn't you come to Ananda and let all the devotees there who love you have a chance to meet you? And she said, I'm there already. They are not bound by their body. They are working through their body, but their consciousness is infinite. And so this little slideshow gives a little taste only of what we were really dealing with when we were with Master. Not a person, and yet a more human person than most people, because he expressed to perfection those qualities. You see, humanity doesn't exist except as an expression of God. To be perfectly human is to be no longer merely human. To be perfectly human means to be a window through which the divine functions. I had an interesting experience to remind me of that reality years ago. I was working in my office at Mount Washington, and behind my desk there was a large picture window. I was down on the ground floor where I could look out through the window at a lovely garden. And periodically through the day, I would relax my eyes and my mind by just raising my eyes and looking through the window at the greenery and the flowers. One day there was a big storm, rainstorm, and mud got spattered all over the window. And after that, I couldn't enjoy the garden because all I was seeing was these splotches of gathered dust and so on the window. Well, for 2 weeks, I just didn't have time to get out there and clean. And then finally, I got a free afternoon, and I got out there and washed the window, and then I came indoors and stepped back from my work, and I said, oh, what a beautiful window. Then I smiled because I realized what made the window beautiful was that I couldn't see it anymore. I could see through it. And this is how it is with us. Only to the extent that we can be seen through, only to the extent that God is able to shine through us, are we able to manifest any beauty at all. The qualities that make human beings beautiful, whether it be love, kindness, humility, sweetness, innocence, energy, drive, wisdom, all these things are manifestations of the infinite. And to look at a wave and say, what a beautiful wave, isn't nearly as expanded a vision as to look at the ocean and say how wonderful that the ocean could produce this wave and many other waves. To look only at one wave is to perhaps ignore the beauty of other waves. To look at one person and be attached to the person is to become limited, as so many sectarian people do. They become limited and speak of only their guru, and no other guru is worthy of mention, and so on. But it reminds me of what, in fact, I wrote in my dedication page in The Path, about the time that we went with Master to see the great Indian movie called The Light of India, about the life of Gyandev or Gyanishwar, one of the great saints of India about 700 years ago. And it was very inspiring. But afterwards, this Bengali disciple whom I mentioned in that script that I just read, Debbie Mukherjee, said, "Oh, but if you had seen the movie of Mirabai, you would hate this movie." And Master said, "Why do you make comparisons like that?" I didn't use the word hate in the book because it has a rather too harsh a connotation, but in fact that's the word he used. And so Master said, "Why do you make comparisons? God plays through all his saints. God is it's all God's manifestation. It's his drama through these different saints. So we should have that kind of respect and love." I've often wished that I could have had more years with Master, and yet I had 3.5, and that's a lot, isn't it? None of you had any years or even any moment with him, so by comparison with you, it's a lot. And there are very few people now left living who ever knew him. And the times that I spent with him, the times of personal counsel, the times of group counsel, the times of advice and inspiration, these things are branded in my heart, and indelibly, I could never get them out. Edgar Cayce, in doing life readings for people, mentioned to several people that they had met Jesus. Even those, if we believe the truth of what, if we believe that what he said was true, I don't really know, but it seems true. At any rate, the thing that is illustrated here is a truth. Those people who met Jesus, even if the contact was merely fleeting, it was an indelible memory that they have carried with them down through the ages. That kind of contact is priceless. That kind of contact which you can have in being a part of such a movement, there is divine power in that, a power that can transform your life as merely coming into a good teaching and practicing good things and reading good books can never do. Power is what we need to, as it says in the Bible, all those who received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. And this is the truth of it, that we receive that power, and only with that power are we able to grow. I've made an interesting observation over the years, and that is that those people who follow Yogananda but don't feel the need to be closely tied to any of his disciples, they just want to go directly to him, they don't get nearly as much as those who really tie in like this directly. And Ananda's an example of that. This power is something that is really conveyed on a one-to-one basis. It's something that comes through me. I don't give it so much as that it comes through me. It comes through you to the people whose lives you touch. I used to think that I didn't have any responsibility beyond turning people over to him. I've learned over the years that that simply isn't true, that I must act as a channel for his power to others. And to the extent that I will that that happen, to the extent that I ask that that happen, to the extent that I'm willing and open to allow it to happen, it does happen. And you all may feel similarly that, well, after all, who are you to act as channels for something so great? You are as important as the greatest star in the universe. You are galaxies in yourselves. Galaxies of divine light. You are as important as anything that ever existed in the universe, because you are God. Or, to put it more truly, God is you. And everything else is not you. The God in you is your reality. And the more you seek to serve as channels for that divine light, the more you will find that that divine light can, indeed, help others. It isn't humility to say, I can't. It's ego. Ego getting the way. Who are you to say you can't? Who is it that can't? The ego can't. If you claim that ego as your reality, then indeed you can't. But if you want to grow in spirit, you must deny that reality and claim the higher one. You must claim the divinity that is your true self. Master's life was entirely intended for this purpose. He came into this world not to show us what a great man he was. He came to show us how great we are. He came to remind us of the God within. When we read his life, to talk only in terms of the things he did is not, in the final sense, meaningful. Oh yes, it's beautiful, but beautiful in the same way that some movies are better than others. Some lives are more beautiful than others. It's not the final reality. No, the reality that he came to bring transcended that personality, transcended even the wonderful example of a high saint, transcended that into just a pure divine light that was pouring through him into the world. Remember in the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna saw Krishna as he really was, it speaks of him as 1,000 arms and 1,000 legs and eyes and so on. What he's meaning is cosmic consciousness that is centered in all beings, that that Krishna's reality wasn't the little body of Krishna, but it was that infinite light whose body was the universe, whose brain was all the brains of humanity in all the galaxies. And so it is that Arjuna, when he had that experience, was frightened. And he said, Lord, please let me see you as I know you, as my friend and charioteer. And so there is a sweetness to that human side, and something that we as human beings need to relate to. But we must always remind ourselves that that higher reality is impersonal, is vast, is implanted in every atom. As Meister Eckhart, I believe it was, said, I move my hand, and Christ moves, who is my hand. So here we have this dual aspect. On the one hand, a sweet and wonderful human being who is our friend, our guru, our teacher, our inspirer. And to have an inward relationship with him in a human way is beautiful. But it is beautiful only to the extent that we include also that higher dimension, that higher reality. In other words, as he said, if you see God coming to you in form as Divine Mother, let us say, you must recognize that in the eyes, lambent in those eyes, is the consciousness of infinity. If you keep that consciousness there, then you will ennoble your friendship, your relationship, your discipleship with him, and even the human aspect of it will become beautiful. I was a young devotee when I knew Master, and there were many things that I never knew while I met him, and didn't have a chance to develop because of my own awe in his presence. Whenever I was with him, I would feel very strongly that I was in the presence of God himself, which in a literal way was true. Knowing, of course, that God wasn't just that, he was everywhere, nevertheless, God was fully expressed there. I remember one night at the desert in the retreat, I was sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor. Bernard and Norman and Boone and a few others were sleeping in the room with me. And I suddenly woke up in the middle of the night with this very strong feeling that God himself was in the room. And I wondered what had happened. I looked out the window and I saw Master's car. And I went to the door and I saw that Master was walking up and down outside. He was just there blessing us. And I went out and got his blessing and touched his feet and came back and meditated. And the human side is always there, and it's so sort of charming Later he said, I thought you were a ghost. But it was too solemn a moment for its power, for the humor really to linger. It was really a powerful thing. The presence of Master was so overwhelming to me that I found it very difficult to be completely natural with him. And over the years, I developed to the point where I understood that kind of relationship, but I never had a chance to have that kind of relationship with him. I had much time with him, and much of that time, somebody was saying that people in SRF have said that I didn't have any time with him alone. I had a lot of time with him alone, but it was a relationship that I would have loved to have more in a more human way, but never had. And a week ago, a great woman saint, Ananda Moyima, left her body. And all these years, I have not shared with anybody the account of our meetings in the beginning when I first met her in India. But I had a relationship with her that was sort of a compensation for not being developed enough, for being too green on the path to have had that kind of relationship with him. In a very real sense, it was as if I was having that relationship with him through her. And I thought maybe you'd like to hear me read the account of my meetings with her, just because it's so timely, since she has only just left her body. My relationship with her in no way diluted my devotion to Master. Rather, it strengthened it. It made him more real. It helped me to understand aspects of our relationship that I could not have understood, perhaps, had I not had this kind of relationship with her. So let me presume on the spirit of the occasion enough to read this little account to you. As I say, I've never shared it before. Just last Sunday, I meditated with a few friends and read this account to them. It's based on a long letter that I wrote but never completed to the SRF monks in Los Angeles, on notes that I made after each meeting with the mother, and on accounts contributed by Mohini Chakraborty, an SRF YSS devotee. Sri Dayamata and her party, consisting of Ananda Mata, Sister Revati, and myself, had been visiting Sri Yukteswar's seaside hermitage in Puri. On about February 9th, this is 1959, we returned to the YSS Baranagar Ashram outside Calcutta, where we were living. Soon after our arrival, we learned that during our absence, Ananda Moyima had come to Calcutta. What a thrill! Paramhansa Yogananda's beautiful account of her in Autobiography of a Yogi had inspired all of us, his disciples, with her example of divine love, with her ecstatic absorption in God's infinite bliss. One of our greatest hopes in coming to India had been that we would have the opportunity of meeting her. Now Divine Mother had brought her figuratively to our doorstep. We looked forward with keen anticipation to meeting her. My own eagerness, however, was not unmixed with a certain anxiety. On Friday of that week, I was scheduled to fly to Madras to lecture at the YSS SRF Center there. Would I be able to see the mother before then? It all depended on whether I could find someone to take me to her, as I had no way of getting there on my own. On Wednesday evening, February 11th, the four of us were sitting with two or three Indian friends around the dining room table. Talk turned, inevitably, to Ananda Moyima and to our prospects for visiting her. But, we lamented, we've no idea where she's staying. It must be in Agarpara, said Mohini Chakraborty, one of the friends who were present. That's where she stays when she comes to Calcutta. Do you know how to get there, I asked. Yes, I could take you. At what time does she generally see people? At about this time. This was not an opportunity to let slip away. I said, why don't we go there right away? My proposal was a bit sudden for the others in our party, but Mohini agreed to accompany me, and minutes later we were on our way. I meditated as we drove through the darkness. A peculiar joy filled me. Did the blissful mother already know we were coming? Was she blessing me even before I met her? Mohini, I said, please don't tell the mother who I am. That is to say, a disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, who was of course well known to the mother's devotees. I don't want the formality of an introduction. Let me just slip quietly into the back of the room and sit there in meditation. That will be a sufficient joy for me. I wanted a spiritual, not a social, contact with the mother. Also, I felt timid at the thought of representing Master before such an exalted being, unworthy disciple as I am. Better just to come in and sit unnoticed. I saw her first through a series of French doors which run the length of one wall of the assembly hall. At once, and every time I saw her again during the days to come, even in semi-darkness when I couldn't distinguish her features, I understood anew the meaning of Master's words when he wrote of the blessing that flows from the mere sight of a saint. There was no mistaking it. I was beholding a truly divine being. I slipped quietly into the room and sat cross-legged on the floor in the back. There must have been about 150 people present. The mother was speaking and laughing amiably. Her voice, as pure and bell-like as a little girl's, thrilled my heart. I closed my eyes in meditation. Soon I began to lose myself in inner peace and devotion. After a time, the congregation stood up. The meeting had obviously come to an end. I couldn't bring myself to move or to open my eyes, but the people around me began talking, so I assumed that the mother had left the room. I hadn't wanted to be introduced to her, but now that she had retired, I thought a little sadly, it would have been nice to exchange just a glance with her, even a loving smile. But she was gone now. And who was I, anyway, to expect any favors? I contented myself with the inner blessing I knew I'd received. I continued meditating for several minutes. Then Mohini tapped me on the arm. I am going to inquire if the mother can be persuaded graciously to come out again and meet you. No, I exclaimed, please don't. It would be too much of an imposition. Her evening with the public is over. Who am I to deserve special favors? But Mohini lovingly disregarded my reluctance. He knew what I really wanted. Approaching one of the mother's devotees, he made his request. Presently word came back that she would see me. I went and stood by the door of her room, my heart beating with a mixture of dread and joy. As I stood there, Sri Ganguly, a devotee of the mother's, sounded a note of mock warning. Beware the cobra's poison. Once you get it in your system, you may never be able to get it out again. Presently she came out. Sweetly she asked where I had come from, how long I had been in India, and a few questions of a general nature. I told her that I'm a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda, adding that, thanks to him, all of us in his ashrams in America felt great love for her. At this she smiled appreciatively, then added quietly, "There is no love except the love of God. Without his love it is not possible to love people." This answer and the way she uttered it so thrilled me that I could make no reply, but only smiled happily. After a few moments, she asked me when I was planning to return to America. I replied, "We'll all be going back to our ashram in April." "Our ashram? Can you tell me where your ashram is, that you must go back to it?" With a smile of appreciation, I corrected myself. "This body is my ashram because it is here I sit for meditation." "No, why your body? Your body is temporary. Ashram is everywhere. It cannot be limited." "In a spiritual sense," she continued, "the meaning of the word ashram is ashram noi, cessation from all activity. In this effortless divine state, all is perceived as one." "In another sense, ashram refers to the four stages of life, brahmacharya, grihastha, vannaprastha, and sannyas. The state of the student, the householder, the renunciate, and so on. But the divine can be known in all of these states, so these two are all one. Everything is one, all one." This last word, "one," she uttered in English, laughing merrily at her own use of a foreign word. Mohini said, "Brother Kriyananda asked me on our way here to let him just come in quietly and meditate, and not to tell you who he is." The mother, gazing at me quietly and affectionately, replied, "But I saw him come in, even though he was unannounced. I was watching him meditate." "What do you mean, however, by the expression, who he is? Who is he, indeed, anyway? Who is anybody?" This little girl, the mother, I learned, generally referred to herself in this way, forgets herself so much she can't even remember who she is supposed to be. Occasionally, someone who has been close to this body for years will be sitting nearby, and I will ask, "Where is so-and-so?" calling this person by name. Sometimes people are disappointed when I don't recognize them, but it is because I don't use this mind as others do. I am led by soul consciousness, by moods. Again, she used the English word moods and laughed happily. By moods, however, she didn't mean that she is moody in the ordinary human sense. But just as human moods are irrational and unpredictable, so the soul consciousness is above reason and is not dependent upon the logical process for its perceptions and decisions. Soul consciousness may sometimes seem whimsical to the limited intellect, but it is never so. The mother mentioned that the following day was the festival of Saraswati Puja, or worship. Saraswati is the Hindu goddess of learning and music. The mother urged me, if I could, to attend the function. Mohini then told her that I sang a few devotional songs in Bengali. She replied, "That is very nice, but it may not be possible to listen to them tomorrow. We shall certainly be able to hear them the following day." "But," remonstrated Mohini, "our brother's difficulty is that he is scheduled to leave for Madras on Friday morning." Impulsively, I intruded, "I'm supposed to leave then, but I'm seriously considering postponing the journey." Everyone, including the mother, laughed appreciatively. Sri Ganguly remarked, "Aha, what did I say? The cobra poison has begun to take effect." Everyone laughed again. Mohini then relayed the wish of Dayamata to meet the mother privately. Because the mother had not yet met Dayamata, she somehow got the impression that it was I who wanted the appointment. "Father," she replied, "you know I do not like to bind myself with appointments. Once I make a promise, I must keep it, regardless of all other considerations. Please speak to Swami Paramananda downstairs and ask him to make the desired appointment for me." She rose to leave. With a full heart, I thanked her in Bengali for having come out especially to see me. The mother smiled. "Thank you is too formal," she remarked. In Bengali, the expression is used less frequently than in English and has a formal ring to it, dhanyawad. "Will you thank your own self?" When I looked puzzled as to what I might offer as an alternative, she addressed Mohini. "Ask him, would he thank his own mother?" "Yes," I replied after Mohini's translation. "In English, it is customary to show appreciation in this way, even to our loved ones." The mother, smiling, then conceded, "Well, if it is customary with you, I don't mind." Lovingly, she gave me a flower and a tangerine, upon which I said with a smile, "Now what can I say to you? Must I accept these in silence?" She replied with a gentle laugh, "Say what you want, it is all the same." I thanked her in English. I guess I'm just too much of a Westerner. Then, with a full heart, I said how happy I was to have met her. As she turned to go, I touched her feet lovingly. Later, I was to learn that it is strictly against the ashram rules for anyone to touch her. But no one, least of all the mother herself, corrected me for my unwitting breach of etiquette. My heart was full. Eagerly, I looked forward to the following day, when I planned to urge the rest of our group to come, too, and attend Saraswati Puja at the ashram. Thursday, February 12th. Dayama and the others had been planning to visit the mother on Friday, but changed their minds on learning that Saraswati Puja was a special day at the Agarpara ashram. We arrived there at about 11 in the morning. Dayama was as anxious as I had been to internalize the experience. She didn't want it turned into a ceremonial encounter between two heads of religious organizations. At her request, therefore, care was taken not to disclose her identity and those of the other sisters. The three of them took their seats a bit away from the crowd and at a distance from the mother. I sat at the back of the crowd. Standing up at one point to locate the sisters, I caught the mother's eye. Sitting down again, I found my meditation instantly deepening. Public curiosity about us couldn't be stifled, however. When the puja ceremony had ended, people approached Prabhashda, Master's cousin, and Mohini Chakravarti and asked who we were. Thus the truth came out. Dayama and the rest of us were immediately invited to come up onto the platform and sit near the mother, who blessed each of us, giving Mataji a garland and the rest of us roses. Many people came forward for her blessings. One woman pressed many gifts on her, but not in a spirit of devotion. The mother turned away from her to face us. Her magnetism drew us into a meditative state. Then she asked me to sing. Nervously at first, I complied by singing Ram Prashad's beautiful song in Bengali, the one I sang this evening first. "Will that day come to me, Ma, when crying, Mother, my eyes will flow tears. I soon lost myself in the inspiration of the words. Most beautifully sung, exclaimed the mother at the song's end. Turning to the crowd, she remarked, concerning us, they are soft. Then, rising, she told us, please remain seated. I will be away only a little while. After she'd left, I sang Master's chant in the Valley of Sorrows in English. She returned after I'd finished and told me, I was listening to you. Please sing it again. I did so, then sang two other songs in Bengali, Blue Lotus Feet and Take Me on Thy Lap, O Mother. What sweetness you express through your singing, she exclaimed. I said, it gives me much joy to be able to sing for you. To which she replied, joy cannot be measured in terms of much or little. It is absolute. A devotee then sang a devotional song in Hindi. While the woman was singing, the mother looked at Dayama long and deeply. Afterward, she remarked to the crowd, look, here you see an example of the unimportance of understanding the words literally. These Americans have not literally followed a single word of the Hindi song. But see how, overcome by the spirit of the song, water is flowing down their cheeks. She tossed Dayama a garland, then gave us all garlands. Of Dayama, she said, she has come a long way to make this contact. Her meditative state is beautiful. The time came at last for us to leave. Using the Bengali expression for goodbye, I said, Dobe Ashi, which means literally, then I come. To say you will come again, she replied with a gentle smile, implies that we shall be separated for a while, but there can be no separation between us. Friday morning we all went together, but I didn't record anything special of that meeting because it was more public. Friday evening, I postponed my trip to Madras so as to take the fullest possible advantage of Mother's stay near Calcutta. Friday evening, I went again, accompanied by Mohini, but without the others. The mother asked me to chant again. I sang Blue Lotus Feet and Will That Day Come to Me, Ma. Later, still under the impression that I, rather than Dayama, had requested an interview, she asked if I didn't want to see her privately. At first, embarrassed to take up her time, I declined, but almost immediately corrected myself and said, yes, yes. Mohini came into her interview room with me to act as translator. But once we got there, I could think of nothing to say. Then I remembered that Brother Turiyananda in America had told me the only thing he wanted from India was Anandamoyi Ma's blessings and some item that she had used. I made this request for him. Very well, she replied. Also, I continued, recalling a problem that was bothering me, my sadhana, my spiritual practice, has been a little difficult in recent weeks. Might I have your blessings and any advice that you'd care to give me? Mother, always think the divine grace is with you. Depend on it, and you will never find it wanting. She paused, then continued, now then, please tell me what you want me to give you of my belongings. Aye, mother, that is for you to say. Mother, no, take anything, bed sheet, shawl, anything. I hesitated. She, will you be shy about asking from your own mother? Aye, but please, I don't know what you need most. She, I don't need anything. Aye, please, at least let one of your devotees choose for you. She, firmly, no, you must choose. Are you not my own? I, wanting to make the smallest request possible. Then, mother, might I have a handkerchief? An attendant rose instantly to fetch one for me. Thinking suddenly how nice it would be to have a memento of my own, I said hastily, mother, might I have two handkerchiefs? Everyone laughed. Mother, taking off her shawl and giving it to me, here, this is for you. I have worn it for 5 years. She gazed at me lovingly. Then, in her mood to give me more, she ordered the attendant to bring me a flower bouquet also. Of the shawl, she told me, wrap your body with this shawl, but always remember that Nam, God's name, is the best thing in which to wrap yourself. Overcome with emotion, I held the shawl silently to my heart for some moments. Then I told her, we all feel that we are not meeting you for the first time. Mother, the more you advance in meditation, the more you will realize your identity with me. Mother, would you give me some personal advice for my spiritual practice? She always practiced japa, taking God's name. Keep your mind busy chanting God's name, and you won't have time to think of anything else. Say, Hari, Hari. Here she clapped her hands joyfully once, as if to indicate that everything of this world disappears with the thought of God. Or any other mantra you like. Filled with his joy, you will laugh at all dangers. I like to take my guru's name. She, that is good. Everything you have attained has come to you through his blessings. I was so full of inner joy by this time that I could only close my eyes in meditation. While I meditated, the mother spoke briefly with Mohini. He told her that I and the others in our party meditated 5 or 6 hours a day. Mother, I can see that. Your American brother and sisters are highly advanced in the spiritual path. Dayama especially enjoys perfect calm both inside and outside. Aye, Mother, you are so good. Mother, sweetly, it takes goodness to see goodness. She gave me the bouquet she had ordered, and the handkerchief, adding to them a large towel. Love filled my heart. Tomar chele kub kushi, I said as we left, meaning your child is very happy. Saturday, February 14th. We went again to Agarpara this evening. Mother asked me to sing Blue Lotus Feet for her again in Bengali. I sang it gladly. Mother, how many times I have asked him to sing this song. In spite of so many repetitions, it never loses its charm. Later I told her, Dayama would like to spend some time with you alone, not to talk, just to meditate. Mother, she is always welcome. I had brought a scarf to give her. Hesitantly, I gave it at last. Whereupon she said playfully, I was going to snatch it from you, but waited to see if you would give it. She then asked me to put it around her shoulders. When I had done so, she repeated 10 times solemnly, Tomar ghore amitaki, I dwell in your heart. I know, I said, thinking of a blessing I had received from her in meditation that morning. I added, Ami tomar chele, I am your child. She, this is not a new relationship. It is eternal. I know. I was thinking both in the human sense of her as a manifestation of the Divine Mother. In time, I became known affectionately to her devotees as Choto Chele, little child. Many were the meetings we had over the months and years after that. Always she showered me with grace. One time she said, many thousands have come to this body. None have attracted me as you have. The translators emphasized several times to me that she had said none. Another time she said, there are people who have been with me 25 years and more, but they haven't taken from me what you have. And to others I'm told she once said, here is a lotus in a pond. Many frogs sit under the lotus, croaking. Then a bee flies in, takes the honey, and flies away. Kriyananda is that bee. She surprised me once by asking, what would you say if I asked you to stay here? Why did she ask me that? Perhaps she saw that I would suffer from my guru's organization. But even had I known what the future would bring, I would have faced that suffering rather than forsake my dedication to him. Perhaps she didn't want me to devote my life to service, but purely to sadhana. I could have remained faithful to Master in her ashram. Certainly she would not have asked me to leave him. That is not her way. But I couldn't set aside his words to me, your life is one of intense activity and meditation. His statement, your work is lecturing and writing, and his frequent charge to me, you have a great work to do. Moreover, I had dedicated this incarnation to spreading his work. I live for nothing else. After my separation from SRF, Ananda Moyi Ma later told me she would gladly have taken me in, but Master himself seems to have prevented that possibility, for I was not granted an Indian visa for 10 years. Nevertheless, Ananda Moyi Ma occupies a more than special place in my heart. I see her as the Divine Mother herself. Through her, next to Master, I have received the greatest blessings in my life. Indeed, with her I was able to have the relationship that my greenness on the path never permitted me to have with Master during his lifetime. It was a relationship which, far from taking me from my guru, served to deepen my relationship also with him. The reading of this, well, I hope it will do for you somewhat what being with her helped to do for me, because, as I say, I was young, I was green, and when I knew Master, there was always that feeling of awe, which, by the time I was old enough on the path to have met her, I could also feel more naturally that childlike kind of relationship. And yet, in having that relationship with her, I was able also to create more of that kind of relationship with Master. And the thing that I would like to urge each of you is to try to have that childlike kind of relationship with God, with Master, with the saints, realizing that God doesn't stand on ceremony. After all, what do we use when we address God? We use the word thou. Thou has come to sound formal because in English we no longer use it in the personal sense that it had originally. But you is formal. Thou is intended to be that which you use to your children, your parents, your dearest. And we address God as thou, as in French we would say tu, or Italian tu, meaning you who are my own. And so Ananda Mui Ma addressed me, will you not make your choice? Are you not my own? Why should I let somebody else choose? This kind of relationship God wants with us. He wants us, Guru wants us to be, not to stand on ceremony, to be just like little children in our trust, in our openness, in our willingness to confide everything openly and lovingly. And when we can, and the more that we can, develop this kind of relationship with God, with Guru, the more we find such sweetness coming into our lives that we realize that that's what it's all about. All this thing of trying to do things that are important and succeed at this or be respected for that or gain positions in society and so on, that's all delusion. We are here as children of the Divine Mother. Naughty or good, we are her children. And our job is to convince her that we really feel that. And when we do, she has no choice but to take us in. That's all she wants, too. Let's have a short meditation.